that her pregnancy continues in the most optimum form, and but is very keenly paying attention to her legislative business. Would you care to introduce yourself, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wayne Leedy, staff for Senator Guest. It was the senator's intent to be here and present the bill. Be here via telephone, present the bill herself. I suppose I could proceed if she's not online. The intent of Senate Bill 10 is to hold minors who vandalize and their parents financially accountable for the vandalism. It makes some changes to existing statute specifically regarding vandalism done by minors. Those changes are to remove the cap on damages recoverable. Currently there's a $15,000 cap, and if a person has insurance that would cover it, the cap is $25,000. This bill would lift that cap. It would allow a court to hold the parents and the minor responsible for the damage jointly liable for that damage. It would require the courts to implement a payment schedule based on the party's ability to pay, basically not require anyone, parents or minor, to pay more than they're financially able to. And it would end parent liability when the child turns 18. So parents and the minor responsible for the vandalism would pay according to a payment schedule until the minor turns 18, at which point the minor would be responsible for whatever damages remain.
I understand Senator Guest is now online. Can you hear us, Senator Guest?
Yes, Senator Dyson. My apologies. I got cut off and had a hard time getting back in.
And your hired man here has been doing an admirable job. Please, would you like to make a statement?
Sure. I heard Wayne go over the bill for the record. This is Senator Guest. I represent Senate District J. The only things I would add to the bill to the presentation at this time is a reminder that we're amending the civil, not the criminal proceedings. In a criminal proceeding, full restitution can be put on the minor child, and along with, you know, jail time and other situations. These are civil proceedings, not criminal proceedings. And just to remind the body, because I've gotten a few questions about the history, we did address this bill 2 years ago in Senate Hess, as most of us remember. It was changed more on the House side than on the Senate side. It went from a $10,000 cap to a $15,000 and a $25,000 cap. The main argument at that time was the concept of not wanting to bankrupt parents with some of these large liability cases, you know, $50,000, $100,000. We've tried to balance this concern that there was 2 years ago with lifting the cap by, as you'll see in the second section, by trying to balance, one, for the first time, holding minors or allowing the court to hold minors accountable, and also saying you have to set up a reasonable payment schedule based on financial ability to pay. And then finally, on saying that the parents are liable for the bill only if the court sees that they're liable, only to the point where the minor child is 18, and then the remaining of the restitution falls on the child. So we try to balance the arguments of 2 years ago of why we can't lift the cap, and tried to broker some compromise with that language. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Senator Guest, it's Dyson. Why do you believe this is necessary?
I believe it's necessary for two reasons. Part of the most important reason is the signal that we send as a community to our young people, and that is that you should be fully accountable for the actions that you take, and right now that accountability is limited. The second reason is one just on an impact of a community. When these types of vandalisms occur, and they're not just against schoolyards, they could be against a business, they could be against a park or a municipality. The remaining, after the cap, the remaining part of the damages are borne by the person who is the victim in this case. Of course, in Anchorage, we know that we've had a lot of school vandalism. And so, you know, after the $15,000, if it's, you know, if it's a $100,000 bill, the Anchorage School District has to pay the rest of it. That's taxpayer money, solely because we have found that we shouldn't hold the person doing the damage accountable.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Guest or Wayne? All right. I have four people I know of that have, three here have signed up to speak. Julie Morris, Carl Rose, and Sheldon Winters. If there's anybody else here in the room that has not signed up, okay, Mary, I'll put you down. And then we have Crystal Kennedy calling in from the Anchorage School Board. Crystal, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Yes, thank you.
Are you on any time constraints?
No, I'm not. I'm ready whenever you are.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to hang on for a minute. Sheldon Winters, are you here, sir? Yeah, would you please come and sit? You can stay there if you like, Wayne. Come on up. Mr. Williams is with State Farm, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, all right. And please introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Sheldon Winters. I'm a lobbyist with State Farm.
Okay. And then is it fair to say that you represent the interest of State Farm statewide?
Yes.
Yes. Any other carriers?
No.
Okay. All right. Please give us your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time. State Farm, primary concern is, of course, with removal of the cap, and primarily for three reasons. First, as Senator Guest indicated, this was an issue that we worked through 2 years ago, just 2 years ago, and with a lot of hard work, there was a compromise reached, which is the current law. That law has only been in effect 18 months, which raises the question of, since then, in that 18 months, how many instances have there been where there has not been the property owner's ability to recover under the current law. We believe we ought to give that legislation that was effective July 1st of 2003 some time to work and see how it is working. Second, we know of no other area where strict liability is imposed on one person, regardless of their fault, for the acts of another. The common law has long stated that it doesn't make sense to do that. It's not fair to do that. With strict liability, you can have a parent that is doing everything right, monitoring their children, training their children. Child goes out, does one bad mistake, and the parent is on the hook. Now, with the current law, of course, the parent is on the hook, but there is a balance for that, and that's the balance we reached. There's a reasonable limitation in the form of the current cap, $15,000 or $25,000 if there's applicable insurance. Now, without the cap, the consequences could be dire, and I can go through many scenarios, but the one that came to mind while I was driving in town today is a family that's saving money for all their kids' college. They've got two or three children, and they've saved up enough money to try to put them through school. One of the bad kid does a bad act, and that college savings plan for the other two is tapped and taken out. So there are consequences here that are not that go beyond affecting the wrongdoer. They affect the parent and other members of the family. And there are all sorts of policy reasons why we just don't hold people strictly liable for the conduct of somebody else. Finally, all this, of course, goes to the potential effect and availability and rates on homeowners insurance. The basic premise of third-party liability insurance and insurance rates is that it's been based on accidental occurrences. Most of your homeowner's policies exclude intentional conduct. Rates underwriting is based on accidents, not intentional conduct. Liability insurance was never intended to respond to vicarious liability for somebody else's intentional destructive conduct. It's one thing to be looked at for responsibility because of negligent supervision or conduct. The parent did something wrong. It's quite another to hold them liable when they did nothing wrong, and in fact may have been supermom or superdad. There is a potential effect on availability of rates, and we would ask that the current law be give us some time to work and see whether it's effective.
Any questions for Mr. Winters?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know if I'm misreading this legislation, do you feel that, Mr. Winters, that the liability of State Farm and all other carriers is increased by Senate Bill 10?
Yes, it is. It does away with Section D.
Which was the $10,000 if you're insured?
Well, it does away with the $15,000, and then it does away with Section D. And Section D currently states if a parent has insurance, an insurance policy that would compensate a claimant for civil damages described under A, and the policy limits are in excess of $15,000, civil damages may be recovered against the parent in an amount not to exceed the policy limits or $25,000, whichever amount is lower. So that the right now the cap is on a parent of 15. If they have applicable insurance, the cap is on $25,000.
Ms. Chairman, I do have to announce my husband is an employee of State Farm Insurance. So but what age does a child have to be, though, for an insurer to be held liable?
I don't believe there's any age.
Number 10 falls under a homeowner's excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
No, you're right.
There are different definitions of an insured under a policy, and typically it's any family member. I don't think there's any age limit on an insured.
So if I might, then if...
I would be curious to learn more about that.
I would too. So my parents are both passed on, but if they were still alive and I did something, their homeowner's policy might be charged, even though I haven't lived in their home for 50 years?
There's a couple problems with that, but correct. If the parents are insured, and there's two aspects of this liability. The first is the negligent or reckless conduct, I should say the intentional conduct of the child. The second aspect of the liability doesn't have anything to do with any type of conduct of the parent. If you are the parent of that child, it has to be under 18, of course, under the statute.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chairman, it's always my understanding that, for instance, this may be a different thing, that if a child in the playground hurt another child and they got a broken leg, then you could go to the other, you know, the offending child's parents, and under that homeowner's policy, it covered the cost of the medical care for them. But I thought it was like under 12 or under 11.
You know, I truly don't know of any age limitation under the policy itself. So I think if you're an insured, you're an insured.
Okay, do you think then that you and State and Allstate and all other carriers or State Farm would then be liable for the full extent of a vandal's actions?
First of all, I can speak for State Farm, but with these changes, and I believe the intent is clear, and we read it that way, that if your 10-year-old goes out and does $100,000 worth of damage, and you have a homeowner's insurance policy, my homeowner's insurance policy pays for that. And there is no $25,000 limit, there is no $15,000 limit. It's the policy limits up to the damage. I believe that's the intent of this legislation.
The sponsors, was that your intention?
Mr. Chair?
Senator, yes.
Through the chair to Senator Green and to Mr. Winters, it was not the intention of the bill at all. The intention of removing Section D was because it capped how much someone could recover. And so it was part of removing the cap. There was no intention of impacting the insurance or how much the recovery could be on the insurance. I'm not sure what the difference between this recovery and another act would be, and maybe Mr. Winters can expand on that, but it wasn't the intention. It wasn't the intention to lift the $25,000, so for example, if it's a $100,000 bill, that full restitution can be paid.
Well, I think, Senator, guess that clarification. All I can go on and what State Farm has gone on is Section D is completely removed, and that is the cap on the insurance policy. It's $25,000, whichever amount is lower. Under the current law, if there's $100,000 in damage, the most the insurer would be liable to pay under the policy would be the $25,000. That section is now removed under this legislation.
Yeah, because I think we probably have to work through this one because I know it was the intention, just based on the language and the explanation and my conversation with Senator Guest, it was to make it very clear that vandals and or their parents are going to be responsible for the damage the vandal has done to these whatever kind of buildings they are. I don't know if it's limited to a certain type of building or not, but so have you considered a correction? Is there anything that makes this better?
Well, with the clarification of the intent, I think we can work on some language together.
Thank you. Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions, Mr. Winters?
I have a couple. I actually have four. I was startled by your comment that the common law has, the implication of your comment was that the common law has never said that parents are responsible for their actions of their children. Is that what you meant to imply?
No, that's not what I said. I didn't mean to imply that, Your Honor. What I believe, if I didn't say this, I meant that the common law has never applied strict liability to somebody for the conduct of a completely different person. So certainly parents are in certain situations responsible for their children, but it all almost always goes back to some sort of knowledge or conduct or lack of monitoring their children. A good example is a negligent entrustment case in an automobile liability case. If my child has 4 or 5 accidents and I still choose to lend my car to my child and he goes out and gets the 5th car accident, then under the law, I arguably could be responsible for that. I did something wrong. I was negligent in the monitoring of my children. Okay? This legislation removes, again, I could be monitoring my child more than anybody else. I could be super dad on this thing, and he goes out and makes, and he could be a super kid for all I know. He goes out and does one thing wrong, and I, as the parent, am held liable regardless of how great a parent I am. That's the difference.
Okay. So I would argue, and I'd be delighted to hear, that I would argue that our common law tradition has always said that parents of minor children are responsible for their conduct and what they do, regardless of their negligence on a specific act, but it's the totality of their parenting and so on. And as I suspect Senator Guest could say eloquently, that's where the responsibility lies. But I would really enjoy being informed on that. Does the fact that this bill provides for the repayment program wherein after age 18 the child assumes all of it, and so I suspect that there will be a payment schedule there, and that you as a carrier for the parent would not be liable for any part of the payment that happens after the child reaches the age of 18. So it's only the portion that the parent and the child are responsible for previous to reaching the age of majority 18 that you as the carrier might be responsible for. Could that be structured in a way that it would help your industry have a limited exposure because you'd only be limited to the parents' portion or helping or assisting the parents in paying their portion up till the age the child reaches majority?
To answer your question, certainly it could be. Our concern would be a 14-year-old child who commits some conduct to a parent who had no knowledge of this child's propensity to do this, and the parent, in my example, has $100,000 saved up for the other children's college. I seriously doubt, and this doesn't require the court, to set up a payment plan where that $100,000 isn't gone by the time the child is 18. So the concern is about the assets of the parents before the child is 18.
All right. And earlier in your testimony, you talked about most carriers assuming responsibility for accidental stuff. Can accidental actions on the part of the your client, can you rewrite your policy so that you're only covering accidents and not the intentional, in this case, criminal actions of your policyholders?
Therein, Senator Wright, lies the rub. The policies already exclude intentional conduct, but follow me through, okay? It would exclude the intentional conduct of the child. The parent, who is the insured or uninsured, is not being held liable for any intentional conduct. They're being held liable for strict liability, and under the policy, the parents would be liable. Even though the primary act was intentional conduct of the children, the parent didn't do anything intentional or even accidental. They are being held liable simply for being the status of a parent. So, yes, it already excludes intentional conduct of the child. It does not exclude, that exclusion does not apply to the liability of the parent under this statute.
Senator Guest, you want to speak to that?
Sure. I mean, I guess I had, for the record, Senator Guest, a few questions regarding what Mr. Winters stated. One is whether or not policies can be rewritten to deal with these cases. I mean, right now it is $15,000, which for most people is quite a bit of money. So it's interesting that lifting the cap is having this much of an impact on the insurance industry. So I would ask whether or not policies can be rewritten to take into consideration new laws such as this to limit the liability of the parents. To the other case, in the kind of the bankruptcy case, I'll go back to the intent of the second section and the individual's ability to make the payments, which is page 2, line 10. There's two things in that section. One is, for the first time, when it didn't happen in the previous law, a court can decide that the parents aren't liable and only the child is liable. It puts the child in with the parents in the court hearing. So maybe you do have the parents that did everything right, and the court can say, you know, you did everything right, and the child will be liable. You can also have parents that really look the other way and have never been accountable. And what I tried to do was give the courts that discretion. So it wasn't always falling on the parents, which it is doing right now. And secondly, it was the intent of the bill that they look at the family's ability to pay so they don't bankrupt the families, and they don't take all the assets and all the education funds from that family or from the other children. If people think that we need clarifying language or intent language to go along with that, when we worked with the drafters and Tam from Ledge Legal was the person who drafted this, that was the direction that we set forth. So I actually think from hearing Mr. Winter's testimony that the intent, a lot of it is the same, I believe. I just also note that it should be in your packet, just in 2004, what the vandalism was in the Anchorage School District. And I think there are four or five schools. And so I appreciate that there was work on this 2 years ago, but I don't think we spent the time 2 years ago to get the policy right. We're still seeing large damages done that I think we need to address at this time.
I suspect we're not going to finish this one today. I want to take all of the testimony. Mr. Winters, how many homeowner policies does State Farm have in the state?
I don't know that off the top of my head.
Do you guess?
Oh.
20,000?
That would It's more? Maybe higher.
Yeah, I would expect so too.
Yeah.
How many claims for vandalism have there been against homeowner policies in the state?
Again, I don't know that. I could certainly find that out.
Could you?
You bet. Try.
All right.
If that exists, I'll get it to you as soon as I can.
Yeah. All right. You raised some good issues, but I want to see if indeed there have been claims. Any other questions for Mr. Winters?
Senator Green. Chairman, I do think that what Mr. Winters just said has something to it, that there's probably not the incentive now to the same extent getting the insurance, their insurer involved, as there would be if it were open. I think it's a totally different conversation. And it's interesting to read the language, though, which says, in the intent language itself says, it's the intent of the legislature to hold those who vandalize property financially accountable for their actions. And if we can get more an intent language in that, then I think you might cure the issue.
Sure.
And Senator, I mean, with the clarification from Senator Guess about setting the intent, I believe we can work towards some more acceptable language on at least some of these issues.
All right. And I appreciate that. Thank you. Crystal, are you still there? Crystal Kennedy?
Yes, sir. We're here.
All right. Please give us your testimony. Crystal, identify yourself for the record.
Thank you so much. This is Crystal Kennedy from the Anchorage School Board, and I'm also chairman of the Legislative Subcommittee of the School Board. And just want to say good afternoon to you all, and thank you so much for bringing this legislation to us. This is very important to the Anchorage School District, you've heard us comment on the struggles that we've had with major vandalism issues in the district for a long time, so it's really refreshing for us to see the attention that you're giving that at this point in bringing this legislation forward. So very simply, we just want to say we are in support of this bill. I hope you have with you a document that was faxed into your office, Senator Dyson, yesterday that gives a rundown of some of the major vandalism events that we've had or acts committed against the district just since the, December 2001 to August 2004. And just to summarize that, it gives a total of $841,058.14 worth of vandalism that have occurred against the Anchorage School District. And of that, we've had $1,700 that we've actually been able to recover. I did want to comment that with the current legislation that took effect in July 2003, since that time, we have actually incurred, well over $500,000, close to $600,000 worth of damages, and in that time, we have been able to recoup $250. So just to kind of put that into perspective for you in terms of what kind of a struggle we do have with vandalism and being able to recover for some of these damages. I just want to take this opportunity to just be in agreement in support with a lot of the comments that Senator Guest made in regard to what her intent was in just designing this legislation, and saying that we agree with that. We do find that it's an issue of taxpayers. They want to know why we don't receive money back from the people that commit these acts, and we certainly don't believe the taxpayer needs to pay for something twice. So I guess with that, I'd just like to say also that we seem to be getting quite a bit of broad-based support on this legislation. The Anchorage Police Department is in support of it. The mayor has signed on in support of it. We have actually even had an editorial from the Anchorage Daily News that has been in support of it. So I just wanted to mention that. And again, just thank you very much. Let you know that this is one of our legislative priorities, so we certainly appreciate seeing the legislation come forward.
Questions for Ms. Kennedy? I might add, this is a extraordinarily bright and capable school board member.
Thank you, sir.
Crystal, of the ones that that you've indicated here, I appreciate the spreadsheet, but how many of them did you not know the perpetrators?
I don't have that information with us. I do have Dr. Larry Widget with me here today, and I'll just ask if he happens to know So many times we end up finding out who they are either through the police department, or as you know, kids will talk. A lot of times they brag. So eventually it just kind of gets through the grapevine. And I can say, obviously, of the ones that are on this list that you see before you, that spreadsheet, those are ones who we do know that the kids who were actually the perpetrators. So I can't tell you how many other acts might have been committed that we don't know who actually did those. But of the ones we do know, that's what this list is made up of.
Okay, so you have the perpetrators here.
Yes.
And the ones that are still pending, the ones that aren't pending, is it fair to deduce that no recovery was possible because there was no assets to go after?
I cannot answer that question specifically.
Senator Dyson, this is Larry Wiggett, the Director of Government Relations. I can say what I'm a little bit familiar with is the Barlow High School, and there's been a total of $250 totally collected, and I believe that there was supposed to be some kind of payment schedule that was set up, but to date, this is all that the district has been able to recover.
For both of you, particularly Larry, it would be very helpful for us to know why we haven't got recovery. And the issue we had was this cap, and particularly we'd like to know if the cap has kept you from getting recovery, and it doesn't look like from the information that you were limited in getting recovery because of a $15,000 cap, in that you only got $1,700. And so it would be very helpful. I mean, we appreciate the scope of the damage that's been done and the impact on students and your budget. But for the sake of removing the cap here, it would be helpful if this list was a bit more definitive to see if the steps we're taking here are going to really help with your problem, because it doesn't seem like it does.
That is a fair question, Senator Dyson, and I think it will be helpful, and I will get back to our administration to make sure that we do provide you with additional information relative to what if the reasoning is, for example, that we're not able to go after a permanent dividend check or whatever the case may be. We will get you that information, sir.
All right. My guess is that there are problems in other places in the system here besides ours. Senator Green?
Yeah, Larry, was that court-ordered restitution when you got the $1,700 and the $250?
Senator Green, I don't have an in-depth knowledge of the case, but I do believe that was court-ordered.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Kennedy? All right. Thank you, Crystal and Larry.
Thank you.
We'll go now. Is Julie Morris here? Hi, Julie.
Hello. My name is Julie Morris, and I am on the Juneau School Board. And I just want to say thank you for having this hearing. And I have been listening intently to pretty much the arguments around the cap. And I have to say that, you know, last night when we had our school board meeting and these two pieces of legislation came up, on Senate Bill 10, we were all in agreement that this is a piece of legislation that we do support, and the school board, we're not as big as Anchorage, so we don't have as many problems or they add up as quick. I was surprised to see that they had, you know, over $81,000 in damage, and that's a lot. That's a hit, you know, on your budget. And that usually means if you're paying, you know, to fix windows or whatever's been broken, that means that you can't spend money on textbooks or whatever else that your school board needs to get for your students. So my biggest concern is that it's money that we need to use for our students that we're using for, you know, maintenance and constantly fixing broken windows or whatever else. I'll just tell you a story of what happened to us a couple months ago. We had someone take a huge rock and throw it through the June Douglas High School window. And those windows are really expensive. They're thousands of dollars worth of windows. So every time one of those gets broken, you know, it takes a while for it to get replaced, and a lot of times we never find out who did it. But when we do find out who did it, we would really like to be able to pursue and get, you know, repayment for that. So I think the legislation is really good, and the Juneau School Board supports it.
Any questions for Ms. Morris? Senator Green.
I just happen to wonder here, do schools have insurance for damage to them?
Oh, I'm sure they do, yeah.
Okay, so were you able to recover the amount for the replacement of the window? Just as an example.
When Anchorage was talking about how much it costs for their vandalism, I don't have that number. And it's a question I have for our superintendent, is to get that number, how much vandalism that we do end up paying for, and how is it being recovered.
I'm just curious, if you have your own insurance for your own structures, or if you're self-insured, and then if you can recover damages when it's, quote, a criminal act against your structure. I'm just curious to know. Thank you.
That's a good question, and I will follow up on that.
Larry, are you still on? That would be a good question.
Yes, Senator Dyson, I'm still on. Sorry, I didn't want to get the button punched. What can I help you with, sir?
Yeah, does the Anchorage School District have insurance that covers against vandalism?
I believe we have the property insurance, and that reference is, from my understanding, we have a $100,000 deductible per incident. And the list that we gave you is of the major vandalism that has occurred since December 2001. And as you know, there are other incidents of much smaller nature that you may have read about. For example, this past weekend in the Anchorage Daily News, where some three bored students were out at 4 o'clock in the morning and decided to vandalize West High School. And I don't know what the amount of damage that was done there, but I know that would be significantly less. And there were two other instances as well that we may have not been reported in the paper at this point in time.
Right, my guess is we'll get back into this issue maybe late next week, and I would enjoy knowing what the other vandalism things and what your carrier has had to pay and what it costs you for that insurance, and maybe a little historical look back on that. Because it's got to be a part of your operating cost to pay that insurance. And I'd like to know what has happened to your building insurance on that. Can you do that, sir?
I will definitely get back to you, sir.
All right. Senator Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, while you're there, I'm looking at your major vandalisms and not talking about the contractor one. It's about $660,000. What's the total budget of the Anchorage School District? Just rough numbers.
$549 million.
So $550 million?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and then the other is, did the same juvenile set fire to the playground equipment in the three different places, or is that three different juveniles?
Oh, those three different juveniles, sir.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
Yes, Senator Green.
Is that $100,000 deductible per incident?
Yes, that is my understanding, and I'll make sure there's absolute clarification for the committee in writing on that.
Thank you.
Very good question. Excellent question. Any other questions for Julie? All right, Carl. Thank you, Julie.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Carl Rose, Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. I also serve on the Board of Directors of the Alaska Public Entities Insurance Company. We insure schools. Just very briefly, I have a written statement, and I will leave it with Wayne here. We endorse what this legislation is trying to do. We think that it's a balanced approach to try to obtain some semblance of justice in terms of, we were here when we first tried to raise the cap, and we were successful at one point with one amendment to get it raised to $25,000. And there was a tremendous amount of back pressure in terms of what that would do to families. And I think what this is going to do is allow the courts to enter in and weigh the consequence and not just have a certain cap that you go to, but to weigh the circumstances of the crime or the actual violation, look at the situation of a family, of a child, what the age is, and what the circumstances might be, and render, I think, what we're looking for is for a fair but accountable method by which we try to recover. Some of the comments that were made earlier, I believe Senator Green had commented on how much we can recover. I think the insurance companies are always interested in some sort of segregation. If there is a loss and someone is responsible for that loss, if it's possible to, I mean, it's in all probability the insurance company will have to pay, but the insurance company may want to seek segregation as well. An example would be in the case of Fort Yukon. They lost their school up there, and it was determined that it was faulty heating tape in the foundation, and so we insured that property, and during the replacement, we pursued segregation for the purpose of trying to recover some of that money. I think it happens all the time with regard to engineering or probably a faulty construction, and I think in this case here, that may be the case as well. If you have insurance, and as has been mentioned, once you satisfy the deductible, the insurance company will pay, but if there's a means to recover some of that money, I'm sure that the insurance company would be interested in doing that as well. So with that, we support the bill and its intent. Some questions have been raised here and some pledges have been made to try to work in a language to make it palatable, and we agree with that as well. So that's our testimony.
Any questions for Mr. Rose? All right. So, Senator Guess?
Yes, sir.
Do you care to make a statement this time?
No, from what I've heard from the committee is you would like me to work on the issues that Mr. Winters brought up, specifically the third party liability and what removing Section D would do regarding third party liability.
Okay, so this committee is Health, Education, and Social Services. Our purview and responsibility here is for the education. And some questions have come up today that I personally think we need some answers to before we move. It could have been that we would say, well, you know, from the perspective of education and education dollars being able to be spent in the classroom as opposed to repairing buildings, we think it's a good piece of legislation and the other questions can be fixed in judiciary. But I'm not going to ask the committee to vote on it and send the problems to judiciary until we've had a little bit more time to look at it and wrestle with a couple of the questions. Senator Guest, do you object to us holding it over? Oh, I'm sorry. Mary Frances wants to speak as well. Come on up, Mary. Senator Guest, if you have any objections to us holding us over for at least another week, you can think about that while Mary speaks to us. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't want you to forget me back there.
I'm sorry.
Mary Frances, Executive Director of the Council of School Administrators. I represent and work with the superintendents and all the school principals and school business officials in the state. We definitely support this legislation. We have a resolution that I'll provide to the sponsors and to the committee for your consideration. I did call and speak to the superintendents in several school districts and was pretty astounded to hear the figures that were being talked about. Ann Short and Fairbanks said that in fiscal year 03 they spent over $70,000 on vandalism, and in fiscal year 04 it was close to $60,000. You just heard about Anchorage. Carol Como said they typically budget $300,000 for this purpose, and it's primarily for repair costs. That doesn't include the personnel costs of cleanup and those sorts of things. Mat-Su also has about $50,000 just for repairs. Juno reported $40,000. These are the big school districts, but when I consider that a single vandalism act in a small school district could very well cost a similar amount, these are staggering figures. They also, in my mind as a former superintendent, kind of represent $50,000 to $60,000 as a classroom teacher. And as you know, all of these costs are costs that do not go toward the 70% that we're required to spend for instruction. Many of the superintendents I talked to said that the costs are never captured. You've heard that. I think these figures from Anchorage demonstrate that. And very few perpetrators are caught. So one district, I believe it was Mat-Su, says they pay for the Crime Stopper rewards. They don't, in their figures, don't consider the personnel costs of the tremendous amount of time involved in cleanup. So, in short, we're very supportive of this legislation. I think the balance and the fairness issue is addressed in this new language, and I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, Mary, certainly one that has become really obvious to me. I would like to know, and if you could inquire of your members, how many of them have had their recovery limited by the 15/25? My guess is you're going to say none. It looks like in average it was none, you know. And so there may be other aspects of the problems in recovery that we need to address ourselves to, and I think we'd be very open to any suggestions. Same to you, Carl, because it doesn't look to me like this, that's the issue. And same for Mr. Winters here. I appreciate his wanting to represent the State Farm, but my guess is it doesn't, there's not been many claims against homeowner policies on this, and I'm thinking that we're spending a lot of time, maybe spending a lot of time and effort on not the key part of the problem. But anyways, I'd like to know how many cases went against homeowner policies, how many cases were the recovery was limited by these arbitrary limits here, and what are the other problems in getting recovery that maybe we ought to be identifying and going after. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Guest, do you object to us holding this over for at least another week?
No, not at all, sir. Mr. Chairman, and I'll work with you and your staff on it, but what I'm hearing is you need the information that you just asked for on kind of the role the limits played and maybe the role of that the limits have played in recovery, other recovery issues, and then trying to resolve or come up with language regarding the third-party liability.
Yes. And the issues that Mr. Winters raised are really interesting, and that is, can we be more clear in the language that limits the parent and or the parent's insurance company liability previous to the child, the perpetrator, reaching majority, and tailor this so that the person doing the damage, the child, carries the major portion of the responsibility after majority, I think. But I think you got the thing clearly, and we'll look forward to it, and I'll wait for your initiative and when you think that we're on top of this again to bring it back up before the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We'll close the hearing on SB 10. We'll now open our work on SB 22. Senator Davis.
Thank you very much. Yeah, before you, Senate Bill 22, presented by me, and I have Richard and my staff is going to do the presentation. But of course, I want to thank you for hearing in such a timely manner. I think it's something that would be beneficial, and I would like to see us get it passed this session if we can. And be willing to answer any questions or whatever need to be answered after we do the presentation.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Benavides, staff to Senator Betty Davis, who's the primary sponsor of Senate Bill 22. In its most simplistic definition, it would basically add birthing centers to the definition of health facility in our statutes to give the ability of these areas to be reimbursed by Medicaid. But it also would create cost savings to the state when it comes to facility reimbursement. According to a check that we did last year, the average cost of a natural birth from four different hospitals in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau is approximately $3,667. And conversely, the facility fees for three different birthing centers in Alaska average approximately $1,400. So there's a savings of approximately a third off right there.
Let me make sure I got this straight. Mm-hmm. You're just talking about the facility charges?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And in a hospital, it's 36 and change. In a birthing center, it's 1,400 and change.
Right. And that,
just for the facility charges?
Yes, sir. That wouldn't include any other services that would be involved. But more importantly, the bill gives families who are covered by the Medicaid the added option of using a birthing center for the delivery of their children. And birthing centers have long been recognized as providing a positive, safe, and friendly, and family-oriented experience for all those involved. So we feel this would be a win-win situation, both in terms of reimbursement for the facility and for adding an extra option for those folks who are covered by Medicaid who wish to have their child in a birthing center. So unless you have any other questions, I'm keeping it short and sweet.
So if I may, nothing we are doing here would change who is eligible for the Medicaid thing. It only, and by implication, anyone who is Medicaid eligible is going to pay one or the other.
Correct.
Okay, so it's not increasing the population of people who will be getting Medicaid reimbursement for their birthing services.
That is correct.
It's only adding another, which you represent is often better and cheaper option that is here. Now, it has been represented to me that some people who are Medicaid eligible, when they are making their choices, when they realize that the birthing center option can't get reimbursed, you know, and they have limited funds, are kind of choosing or feel they're being forced to choose the hospital option because of this problem that you all are trying to solve. Am I clear?
Yes, sir.
All right. There are questions for?
I'd like to know where the fiscal note is.
It's got it.
Thank you.
And they're saying zero. Or we'll maybe have somebody from the department will explain that to us. Anything else, sir?
No, sir.
Any questions?
I can stay here and answer questions as they occur.
All right. Are there people who are signed up to testify who have time constraints? All right. Then, are the committee members that cannot stay till 4?
Yes.
Take
that long?
I can't stay
till
4.
You need another 3:30? Mm-hmm. All right. So we'll proceed and take the... Are there people here in the audience who can't come back next week to a hearing? All right. I'm sorry. All right. We'll take the folks off net then, and I have a list of 7. Are any of you that could not testify at a subsequent hearing probably next week? All right, we'll take them then in the order you signed up. Tara Garrick, the Midlife Birth Center. If you can hear me, we can't hear you. Look for a mute button on your... Tora, can you hear us?
This is Laura Gore. I don't believe Tora is on. We can't hear her if she is.
All right. Well, go ahead, Laura, and give us your testimony, please.
I've been part of birth centers in Anchorage for approximately 10 years, and you know, this has been an issue that we have worked on for a very long time. And basically, we've also had clients that have come through that are eligible to deliver at the birth center in terms of their risk factors, their low risk, they choose either at a certain point in their pregnancy, they have to decide to either go to the hospital or have a home birth because they have no way to pay their facility fee. And I think that we end up with a lot of our clients choosing hospital, which is not really what they want, and also costs the state more money. But they do end up making that choice due to their financial situation. And I think over the years I've actually seen that increase rather than decrease. I don't know the reason for that, but I have seen an increase in people that say, you know, I just can't afford it. Part of that is with operating a licensed birth center takes a fair amount of staff, and we have to have the reimbursement to be able to operate. The birth center that I worked for previously did have a fairly high clientele of Medicaid births, and unfortunately ended up dissolving partly due to financial strain by not being able to get proper reimbursement for Medicaid clients. So I'm really hoping that this will not only help our clients, but it will also help the owners of the birth center, making them be able to sustain themselves financially. And I am operating currently Moonlight Midwifery, and I'm the administrator for Geneva Woods Birth Center.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Gore? And Karen Brown, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm Karen Brown. I'm one of the co-owners of the Geneva Woods Birth Center. I also work with Laura Gore. I think Laura has very well spoken for the reasons that we are seeking reimbursement for clients so that they can have more of a choice as to where they would like their birth to happen. I guess I really don't have anything much more to add other than to say that I'm in support of this bill.
All right, thank you. And I appreciate the consideration of not reiterating the same things. Sharon Evans and Judy Davison of Matsu Midwifery?
Yes. My name is Sharon Evans, and I work at Matsu Midwifery in Westella, which is a freestanding birth center. I just want to give my support for this bill, and I'd like to say that at this time, Medicaid pays facility fees in 12 states in the United States. Birth center facility fees are, as has already been spoken, substantially lower than hospital facility fees. And birth centers offer a safe, cost-effective alternative to the escalating maternity care fees now seen throughout the nation. And I'm very pleased to see that our Alaskan legislators are looking at SB 22, which, if adopted, would allow for needy families to have access to the same options for birth that self-paying families and those with insurance have. And by adopting Senate Bill 22, the state of Alaska will save large amounts of Medicaid funds as more low-risk Alaskan families choose birth center births. Thank you.
I have a question for you.
Senator Green.
I just have a question. Do you know in the states that you mentioned where there is Medicaid available, does the federal government participate?
It's state, just like the state of Alaska.
Pardon me?
It's each state has the Medicaid is it's on their own.
Okay, each state is 100% Medicaid. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, and Judy Davison at Matsu.
Yes, I'm the owner operator at Matsu Midwifery in Wasilla, and I just want to say that I think Alaska has excellent midwifery standards, both for the direct entry midwives and the nurse midwives, because of the past efforts of our legislators. They really responded to the voice of families in this state that have desired midwifery care over the years, and we provide an excellent service. They're now birthing centers because of our just the distance that some of our families have to travel to have their babies. Birth centers are an integral part of midwifery, the midwifery model of care. And this model has proven over the years to be cost effective and have lower risk to moms when they're attended continuously by the same midwife. We really appreciate that we have the abilities and the services here in the state. also something to note is insurance companies, many insurance companies recognize the lower risk and lower cost of our care by paying 100% of birth center fees, whereas the hospital fee is sometimes only covered by 80%. So I really hope that we get this bill passed. I believe that it will provide thousands of Alaskans the opportunity to choose a safe, non-interventive, cost-effective alternative to really the alarming rise in maternal health care costs that we see today.
Any questions for Judy?
Yeah, I have one.
Senator Green.
I was reading a summary that someone over at, I think, Hess had done regarding a number of births in Alaska over the last few years, and home delivery was going up and birthing centers was going down. And do you know why that is?
We don't see it in this area. In the center that I practice in, we see probably more than three-fourths of our clients are birth-centered births, and about one-fourth are home deliveries. I don't know where that statistic was taken, but home deliveries have traditionally been about 1% of the birth population. And I believe in this state, since we have 7 birth centers now, we're going to see the birth center rates go up.
Well, this goes back to only 2002 and 2003, so we didn't have the last 2 years, but there were apparently some conclusions that maybe there was a trend away from birthing center births and toward home delivery, and I was trying to figure out, could that be because?
This is Laura Gordon. I think I could speak to that a little bit. I think part of that was that we saw 2 birth centers in Anchorage close down during that period of time. Probably the reflection of that was that there were less choices for people in Anchorage at that point because the birth centers folded due to financial reasons. Midnight Sun closed in 2001, and Bearing in Mind closed 2003, and those were both listeners that did a fair amount of listener deliveries. So I think that maybe we've seen a reflection of those facilities no longer in operation.
Thank you.
All right, we're running out of time here. Jack Nielsen, Department of Health and Social Services, you online, sir?
Yeah, this is Jack Nielsen, Mr. Chairman.
Please at least give us a brief comment here, and then we have some questions for you, sir.
Okay, sounds good, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for an opportunity to speak. The department is basically neutral on this bill, but we would like to raise a few points that we'll probably have to deal with if it passes. The bill adds birthing centers to the list of health facilities whose Medicaid payment rates are required by state statute to be established based on reasonable costs related to patient care incurred by the facility. But the bill really doesn't seem to add the birthing centers as a Medicaid service authorized by state law to be offered by the program. That list of authorized services is actually in Alaska Statute 47.07.030. If this authorization to cover birthing centers was in 030, it would make it absolutely clear that we can cover it under Medicaid, and it would help us in dealing with a potential federal issue that we might have out there. There's a question whether birthing centers are an allowable Medicaid service that the federal government will participate in financially. Although some states have obtained federal participation in the past, the federal criteria are not clear. And recently it's become more difficult to gain federal approval for a new provider types that are specifically defined in those federal guidelines. We would certainly make every effort to to gain federal approval, however, if we were not successful, payments to breeding centers would be state general fund only payments rather than payments matched by the federal Medicaid program. The type of federal approval we were able to gain could also somewhat guide the methodology that we would be using for calculating payment rates for the breeding centers. So until we have written approval from the federal agency, we wouldn't know for sure the answer to some of these federal type questions. In 2004, there were close to 10,000 births in Alaska. Approximately 50% of those were Medicaid. Overall, on those 10,000, 2% of the births were in breeding centers. That would project out to maybe 100 or so Medicaid births per year in breeding centers if this provider type were adopted. Some of the other factors, maybe they consider an estimating cost of this provider type would include breeding center fees are lower than hospital payments. When a Medicaid patient chooses to go to a breeding center rather than a hospital, there's varying figures on it, but the department has an independent study that shows there's at least a 22% savings on that. On the cost side, there are things to consider like implementation costs, regulations, changes to the claims payment system, new costs if there's a shift from home births to the breeding centers, cost of hospital transfers if necessary, and of course, again, depending on the rate setting methodology that ultimately gets adopted. The department believes there would be both savings and costs with no overall cost increase. Rate setting for these seven or eight breeding centers as described in the bill could be accomplished without additional resources at the department. That would conclude my testimony unless anyone has questions.
Thank you, Jack. Mr. Nielsen, we'd really like to have those comments in writing if you have them. And we have received a zero fiscal note here, and I haven't read all the footnotes on it, but we will take this bill up again under bills previously heard. And as soon as we get a few of these questions about the cost, I would encourage the sponsor to get the comments from Mr. Nielsen and I'm going to put this birthing center in the other section of the law that he mentioned, and both of you to work together to see if we could put some contingency language in here of what would happen if failing the federal agreement to fund the birthing center's facility charge. And Mr. Nielsen, I understand the department has not yet completed the regulations for the birthing centers. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that there may be some regulations associated with licensure from last year's bill. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, sir.
Virginia Stonkus from the Division of Public Health in the department is there in the audience in Juneau. And I think she'd be in a better position to answer that question than I.
Right. So when we reconvene on this issue, I want to know what the status is on the regulations and when they're going to be finished. Any other questions for Mr. Nielsen? All right. Senator Davis?
I do have a question, clarification or question.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Nielsen, did you not say even if federal funds were the fair share didn't come from the federal government, that if the total amount was picked up by the state, there still would be a cost savings?
I think my answer was more along the lines that the state would be paying 100% of the bill rather than 50%. Again, the independent study that the department had showed a 22% savings. The federal match for Medicaid for 2006 is around 50%, so I probably wouldn't quite cover using that 22% figure at least.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and Mr. Nielsen, it was represented to us earlier here that instead of a 22% savings, it's more than a 50% savings on a difference in it, and I would enjoy your working with the prime sponsor here. We had heard that earlier that hospitals charge $3,600 for a facility charge on average, and the birthing center is $1,400.
More than happy to work on that.
We'd like to have something pretty definitive on that. One or both of you to be able to defend your figures on that. Any other questions from committee members? All right. We'll hold this over to this next week. It will come up on their bills previously heard. Encourage everyone who has bills referred to Hess, Senate Hess, to get prepared and get them to us. We have a lot of work to do this year. It's been our intention to, as we've done today, to jump on the ones that are ready to go and put them behind us, particularly ones when there's only one bill on that subject and not several of them. And any other business to come before the committee today? Thank you for your attendance and participation in the journey. Thank you very much.